beans, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Expendables 4, No One Will Save You, The Continental, The Supermodels, and Frankenhooker. I'm also going to be talking about some news, The Trailer Park, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Splice, one of my favorite horror movies of all time. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. If you want to reach out to me on Blue Sky or Mastodon, I'm at Kevin Carr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Let's just hit the box office really quick. It's interesting to note that The Nun 2 actually squeaked out ahead of A Haunting in Venice last week by like $200,000. The Nun 2 held, it was like 55%, which isn't great, but it's pretty good for a horror movie, and it gave A Haunting in Venice a run for its money. It's the lowest opening for one of the Poirot stories that Kenneth Branagh has done. I tend to like them, but they're not huge money makers. The first one, Murder on the Orient Express, got a international total of like $300 and some million. I would love to see him do a whole bunch of these, but just not blow the bank on it. You know, do like $30 million versions of these movies and have some fun with it. And that's really the only thing that's going to sustain this sort of thing. But other than that, Barbie's still in the top five from last week, even though it went to VOD, which is really impressive for a film. It's been on in the top five for like 9 weeks, which that's like Avatar numbers, just to put that in perspective. Another piece of news is, and this is ongoing, and by the time you hear this, you know, things can change, but finally the WGA and the AMPTP are talking. They are in active negotiation. There's been some narrative in the press, probably spun by the studios and their crisis team, to make it seem like it's going to be a quicker resolution than it will be. This is still going to go on. Even if they get all this stuff signed, sealed, and delivered this weekend in terms of what the negotiating committee wants, you have to put it out in front of the membership. The writer's strike has been going on for over 140 days. The longest one ever was 153, 154. So that puts us around October 2nd. That this will become the longest strike. And already, by the time you give people a chance to vote on this, you're almost in that territory now. So this is still going to be a historic strike. And then they got to figure out what to do with the actors. So this is far from over, but at least we're seeing some progress and some movement from both sides. Another thing I want to hit that hit the news this week, the Sunday Times did an expose on Russell Brand. A lot of people in America, they know who he is, they recognize him, but he's not a huge media figure. He's much more recognizable in England because that's where he's from and that's where he kind of gained his early traction. And by the time he was famous there, he came over to America. He made a bunch of movies like Get Him to the Greek, which was a spinoff of Forgetting Sarah Marshall, I think. And then he did movies like Hop and he did the remake of Arthur. Russell Brand has been accused by multiple women of sexual misconduct, sexual assault. And, of course, he's denying it all, as you expect. One of the more interesting things about celebrities today is with social media, you can put something out there completely by yourself. All you need is a cell phone and a social media account, and you can set something up. And that's burned people in the past. Look at, for example, the Mila Kunis and Ashton Kutcher apology video for writing letters of support for Danny Masterson. It looked like a terrorist hostage video. They look like they just rolled out of bed. They didn't even bother to shower for their apology video. Same thing with the Drew Barrymore apology issue when she was apologizing for putting her show on. You don't have a crisis team but a bunch of PR people writing it. Or you do, and this is what they think is going to be most authentic. I played the clip of the Russell Brand, but I don't want to give too much attention to him in particular and his outlets. And you can't even hear it, but when you watch the clip, when he says, "All of my sexual encounters have been consensual," there's an edit right before consensual. If you're making an apology video about sexual assault, you probably should not involve an edit right in the middle of saying everything was consensual. I realize they don't have anybody supervising this stuff. They're doing what they think is great. And you know, people like Drew Barrymore and Mila Kunis and Ashton Kutcher and Russell Brand, their job is to be presenters and media figures and personalities. Their job is not to allow spin and doctor this stuff to make them look good. And so when you do it yourself, it looks kind of terrible. So this Russell Brand stuff, this is Bill Cosby 2.0 at this point. The only difference is Bill Cosby was like a family-oriented entertainer, and Russell Brand never was. He used his bawdy, hypersexual personality to then beg forgiveness for all the indiscretions. And now you just have to search, and you see all these, literally these scenes where he's doing things that are offensive and levels of assault that's captured in interviews, and it's not looking good for this guy. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first trailer I want to talk about is called Dream Scenario. It's an A24 film, and it's coming out on November 10th.
You've been on my mind recently.
Yeah?
Because you keep popping up in my dreams. You don't do anything. You're just there.
So, this specific person, the remarkable nobody.
I've also had that experience.
Do you have a picture?
Have you been dreaming about me?
Have I been dreaming about you?
Yeah.
Why me? I don't know. I'm special, I guess.
You're scaring me, Pearl. I'm going to have nightmares.
This one stars Nicolas Cage, apparently as a guy who people just randomly start dreaming about, and he finds a measure of fame in that, but it never goes well. And there's something darker and more sinister, I think, happening. I don't know. There's this weird mix of horror movie vibe and goofy comedy vibe on this one. It also reminds me a lot of A24's other sort of reality-bending movie from this year, Beau Is Not Afraid, which I like to a degree. It just, if Beau Is Not Afraid was 90 minutes long, it would have actually been really fascinating. It just was punishingly long. It was like 3 hours. This one feels like it's kind of got the same connective tissue about some guy living in this surreal world that is very personal to him and has a very big impact, but you don't know what's real and what's not. So I'm very curious about this, although Dream movies can be really dicey and problematic because no one ever gets dreams right because they're always so personal to people. The next trailer I want to talk about is The Hunger Games, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes in theaters November 17th.
Mr. Snow.
What are The Hunger Games for?
The Hunger Games, they're to punish the districts.
Those tributes don't have a choice.
Your role is to turn these children into spectacles, not survivors.
You want to protect people, and it's essential to accept what human beings are and what it takes to control them.
I actually saw this in the theater as well, the trailer for this, earlier this week. And, I mean, it looks like an authentic Hunger Games movie. I'll give you that. And it's got some big name stars in it. You got Viola Davis in there. You heard her in the trailer. One of them being Rachel Zegler, who, of course, she's polarizing now because you have a whole bunch of racists who don't like her being Snow White going after her, which is stupid. And I've talked about that before. Leave her alone. Let her have her movies. But the problem with this Hunger Games prequel is while it looks interesting, I just don't know if there's any sort of desire to have another Hunger Games movie. It's sort of like the Fantastic Beasts movies. There was no real calling to have those. And we realized that was not a giant money-making marketplace situation. And I feel it's the same way with the Hunger Games. That series and that story was told. And I don't know if there's anybody clamoring to hear the prequel version of it. And on top of it, you don't have Jennifer Lawrence. And Jennifer Lawrence was this unicorn that just suddenly appeared, and Hunger Games clicked right at the right time, right when she was becoming big, just enough time to capture the popularity of the books, and right before she blew up as an actress. So, I don't know. It's this one I just think is feels like a misfire, but it looks mildly interesting. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about The Continental, and no one will save you. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the new reviews. I'm not going to say movie reviews because this is actually a mini series on Peacock I'm going to be talking about. And that is The Continental. In this John Wick prequel, the story of Winston Scott's rise to power in the 1970s at a hitman hotel is told.
We made a big mistake coming here.
You're my brother, Frankie.
We have to strike first. And I need all the help I can get.
If we're gonna take on the Continental, every freak in that hotel will be after us.
We need guns. Lots of guns.
I like the John Wick films. I'm not crazy about them. I mean, there are people who just are like, John Wick is the greatest thing ever. It's exactly what an action movie needs to be. And I'll admit, some of them, they're a little long. I really don't think that we needed four John Wick movies. We probably could have done with like two. But they're still enjoyable to watch. And but part of what makes John Wick movies work is the title character of John Wick. Because we have all been in situations like John Wick, not in terms of assassins and stuff, but in terms of something where you just want to be done with something and you just keep getting dragged back into it and you can't escape. We've all had situations like that in our lives. So we are immediately able to relate to John Wick, even though it's in this absurd, over the top violent world that most of us don't live in. This prequel is different. It's telling the story of the Continental, and that's the character of Winston, who's played by Ian McShane in the movies, a younger version of him coming to power. So you really have to want to know the history of John Wick. You really have to want to know about this hitman universe and the high table, and you want to delve into that. And I don't know if people are all that interested in that. I think they're just more interested in the person who's running from that. But overall, I mean, as a filmed element, there's some good stuff in there. There's some good action in there. The soundtrack's really good. Well, I mean, the soundtrack, it's almost like overly aggressive needle drops. It's like every single famous song you associate with the 70s. It's not subtle about it. I mean, they just keep doing it. And at a time, you're like, okay, dial back, WKRP. We don't need to hear every single song that was popular at the time. But the biggest problem with this is there's no John Wick in it, obviously, because I don't even know if the character was born at this time. Without John Wick, you also don't have Keanu Reeves, and Keanu Reeves is the heart and soul of that franchise. Instead, you have a bunch of relatively not terribly recognizable people. There's no star power in it. The biggest star you have is Mel Gibson as the bad guy. He's the one who runs the Continental. And already he's a polarizing figure. I literally know people who are like, I'm not going to watch a Mel Gibson movie because of some of the things he's said and done in the past. It's the same thing that happened with The Flash. There's a lot of, I personally know people who said they didn't go see The Flash because they didn't like the involvement of Ezra Miller. And you can sit there and whine and complain about cancel culture all you want, but it's everybody's choice to not go see a movie if they don't like the person in it. And it'd be one thing if Mel Gibson was just one of many stars in this, but he's the only really well-recognizable face. I mean, one of the guys who's basically plays a version of a John Wick-type character looks like Travis Tritt. And you're like, well, if I wanted to watch a 70s version of Travis Tritt try and fight these hitmen, I'd see this, but it just doesn't, I don't know who was calling for this. Then on top of it, it is long and drawn out. That's the other major sin. The first major sin is there's no real star power behind it. Second major sin is it's kind of dull. It has these, they're 3.5 hour long episodes. It could have been a single movie. Could have been 2 hours, 2.5 hours, and you could have really crammed all this in there. It's just at times you feel like they're just marking time. So I wanted to like this. I really did. I was very excited to see it, but it's a bit of a slag. I mean, there's some classic John Wick elements provide excitement, but the pacing and lack of star power slows this miniseries down to a crawl. It should have been a single movie. I'm going to say that, unfortunately, The Continental kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about another show that's on streaming. Well, this one's actually a movie. It's called No One Will Save You. It's exclusively on Hulu right now. And it stars Caitlin Dever as a small-town pariah who encounters a home invasion of mysterious creatures. Now, that trailer was unique. I don't know if you noticed anything. A trailer like this scares the heck out of talk radio people because there's no talking in it. It's all sound. And when I was originally assembling this trailer for it, I was really worried because there's no dialogue in it. And part of that is because it's sort of the catch of the movie. I'm not going to say it's a gimmick because I think it exists beyond its gimmick. It just has an interesting framing device. And that is... no dialogue. It doesn't have people talking to each other. Every now and then you hear somebody mutter something under their breath or in the background, but you don't have any dialogue. You don't have any times where the characters talk to each other. And I think that's an interesting perspective because the whole point of this movie is how alienated Caitlin Dever's character is. She doesn't have anyone to talk to. She has no communication with anybody. So even though she can speak, she's sort of in this mute world. But the reason I decided to put that stuff in the trailer is you got a chance to hear that the sound of a movie is more than just dialogue. There's sounds that you can hear what's going on. You can hear at the point where she's dialing a phone and you can hear her walking around. You can hear this creature chittering in the background. There's stuff happening. It reminds me of this time I interviewed Andrew Stanton. And it was in like his round table and we were talking about WALL-E. And somebody asked him, said, well, WALL-E doesn't speak. And Stanton looked at this person and was like, he speaks. He speaks all the time. You just don't know what he's saying. And that's true. You can have a movie that has no discernible dialogue, but we all know what's happening. And that's what's one of the strengths of No One Will Save You is because it utilizes that. By not having the dialogue, it utilizes the sound of the house and the sounds in the background and the loud. And it doesn't overdo the explosive loud noises, although they're certainly in there. And a lot of it's on Caitlin Dever's shoulders. I mean, she's such a good actor that she can carry a movie like this. I mean, literally carrying an entire film without a lick of real dialogue in it. It's all about her emotion and her acting, and you have sympathy. And she gives you all those character moments. This is an effective movie. One thing that I think is funny is this seems to be a thing with Hulu movies, because this happened with Prey last year. People are so mad. Instead of seeing this movie and people saying, oh, this was a really cool movie, isn't it nice? They're like, oh, this was a really cool movie. Why was it not in theaters? Oh, you should have done a theatrical release. And I don't know, would this have done well in theaters or would it kind of flopped? I don't know. I mean, but the whole point is Disney is trying to figure out a way to make the streaming products work. And it's no different than doing a TV movie. It's just you don't have restrictions on standards and practices. But I enjoyed watching it at home. I thought it was an effective movie. It's tense and strongly leaning into the horror roots. This thriller is propped up by a great performance by Caitlin Dever. I really enjoyed this. This is a neat little find that should give a little bit of traction and lead us well into October with the horror movie season. I'm going to say No One Will Save You rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Expendables and the Supermodels. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews that are in the theaters, or the one that's in the theaters. Expendables 4. It's written with the A as a 4, so it really is Expendables. A group of mercenaries are given a job to take down an international arms dealer who has stolen nuclear detonators.
Why are you here?
I got this situation where I need your help.
I need bad friends.
Terrorists have taken possession of nuclear missiles on a cargo ship off the coast. If these babies go off, it'll be World War III.
Take cover!
To choose this life over friends, over family.
It's time to get loud.
Look, I was a child of the 80s. I'd seen some of these action movies, certainly at home, on home video. But the ones, some of them in the theaters. So I grew up with these kind of gritty 80s action movies. And I understand what the goal of the Expendable movies have been. To pay tribute to these macho action movies of the 80s and 90s. The problem is every time they make an Expendables movie, they get it wrong for some reason. Stallone did the first Expendables movies, and it was neat to see everybody back, but it was Stallone directing, so it was this overly heavy, you know, morose movie that was a little more contemplative, and it was something that Stallone will do with his movies, but it just didn't have the punch of something like Cobra from the 80s. When they did the second one, they said, well, we've got all these aging action stars. They're going to not be able to continue the franchise eventually. So let's put a whole bunch of younger people in. They put people like Liam Hemsworth and Ronda Rousey. I mean, they were trying to get people who had some experience, but they didn't have the iconic nature of some of these older generation actors. And then they did the third movie, and then they're going back and forth. Should we make a PG-13 or R? And I'm like, make it R. It's an R-rated movie. Why are you literally are trying to aim for a very specific audience, the people who like the 80s action movies that we saw with Schwarzenegger and Stallone and Chuck Norris and Dolph Lundgren. And then you're like hemming and hawing about whether or not to make it like those movies. Why don't you just do what you said you're going to do? Why is Randy Couture in this movie? Who the heck cares about him? Does anyone really consider him an action star? Oh, he's done a couple movies, but not really. Why is Curtis 50 Cent Jackson in this movie at all? Why did anyone let him anywhere close to it? Megan Fox plays a main role in this movie. She is awful. She's a terrible actor. And this movie proves it. Every single line of dialogue is like nails on the chalkboard. And then the same thing, there's a trailer out there of this where they're like, we heard you, you want to make this R-rated and violent. And I'm like, you didn't make that decision when you were shooting it. There's all these shots in the movie, the most violent shots in the movie, they feel like either reshoots or digitally improved to make it violent. And that's exactly what happened with the second movie. They decided to shoot at PG-13, and at the last minute they said, let's go R, and they just added a bunch of digital blood. But that doesn't give you the feel of an 80s action movie. They didn't have digital blood back in the 80s. Make it visceral and gritty. You lose all that grit. And then this one, the main action stars you'd want to see, Stallone and like Lundgren and those people, they're either not in it or they're minimized a lot. And then you get these other people. I don't even know who some of these people are in this movie. And on top of it, you get some of the worst special effects. There's literally a scene where Stallone and Statham are outside a suburban house and the background's blue screened in. And I'm like, why? There's a scene where they're in Thailand and they have this big mountain. And say, yeah, fine, blue screen that in. I get that. I understand why you do that even. But why a suburban house? Just go to a suburban house and shoot. This is why movies cost so much. I don't understand what they were thinking. And then they... Like, the pacing is really weird. Like, there's two things happening. They're cutting back and forth between two stories, and one of them's taking weeks, and the other one's taking a couple hours, maybe? And that doesn't make any sense. It's disjointed, and it's not well put together. And it doesn't even stick to what it's trying to do. I mean, it's the fourth movie, and the franchise is still trying to decide existential questions like, is this an old school action stars or new wannabes, and whether or not to be PG-13 or an R rating? It's more frustrating watching this movie than it is entertaining. It doesn't even, it feels like a direct to video piece and not something that was born of something like Invasion USA with Chuck Norris back in the 80s or Cobra with Sylvester Stallone. It's so disappointing that this is the fourth time around and they can't figure out what they're doing. I'm going to have to say Expendables totally sucks.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's have another throwback, and we're going to be talking about the supermodels. This four-part docuseries looks at the rise to fame of Christy Turlington, Cindy Crawford, Naomi Campbell, and Linda Evangelista.
Cindy, Linda, Christy, and Naomi are still redefining what it means to be a model.
There was a feeling about them that they wanted more.
I was not seen as a person who had a voice in her own destiny.
Freedom! Everything changed.
Freedom! You can start to call the shots and be an active participant in your career.
All of a sudden, we were the physical representations of power.
This is available on Apple TV Plus. It's like I said, there's four parts to it. They're about an hour long each. I grew up with this. I'm about the age of a bunch of these. I think I'm like bang on exactly the age of Christy Turlington. Cindy Crawford's a little older, and Linda Evangelista, they're both a little older. But Naomi Campbell and Christy Turlington are right about my age. Whenever you get a show like this where they're trying to show somebody's career and that person's involved with it, not just as an interviewer, but I think their team's involved in the overall look of this documentary, you don't really get a truthful feel to it. You get this feeling that this series is made to heap praise on the supermodels and say how great they were. And it does show some interesting stuff. I mean, it shows sort of the seclusion that they had, sort of the isolation that they developed and how they had a team that developed them. There was fashion photographers and moguls and PR people and that who basically handled them and got them where the girls were just, oh, go here and do this. And you can tell, especially early in their careers, their rise to fame is they were just really good at doing runway work and they had a good look. They were pretty. And congratulations, but you won a genetic lottery, but it didn't use any brains or smarts. Everybody else was managing you to get to you where you were. You were just very, very good at doing this presentation, and it happened right at the time where media was exploding into the 90s. But one of the problems with anything like this, especially if you're looking back 30 years, it gets very sanitized because the point is this is supposed to make it look good for the girls. And I question the whole, oh, they're brilliant. They're it's effortless. I'm like, okay, Cindy Crawford, you still look good on camera, but you have an entire team of people to do your hair and your makeup and your fitness and your background and everything. I could look like Cindy Crawford if I had a team of 50 people taking 3 hours or more every time I'm going to go on camera. And as you watch this and you see how many people are feeding into this, you realize, are they really that unique or were they managed and were they built like this? But I don't even think that's the point that they're trying to go for. The other thing that's a real problem is there's some really creepy stuff that goes on in the supermodel. I mean, the fashion industry is just replete with creepiness. And whenever one of those things shows up, they're kind of like, it was the 90s. It was a different time. And there are people who are completely complacent in some really predatory behavior that was going on. And they're just like shrug and they're like, the 90s. And that's a problem. like John Casablancas was a sleazebag. I'm sorry. I don't care how influential he was. He was a sleazebag. He was a sexual predator. He went after young girls and he had access to them. And the stuff we know, like him dating young girls, like, under 18, what don't we know? It's got to be horrible. And they just always brush that under the rug. They're just like, oh, no, it was just a different time. You know, it's an eye-opening look at the fame trajectory of these women, but the more unsavory elements are conveniently stripped away, and this ends up playing more like a PR feature than a hard-hitting documentary. If what you want to see is how these four women got their power as supermodels, it works. I'll say that it kind of rocks. For what it's trying to achieve, I just think it could have achieved so much more.
It kind of rocks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I will be talking about Frankenhooker and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Splice. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies. I have calmed down a little bit from my rants about Expendables and the supermodels. And I am ready to talk about something a little more fun. You know me, it's Halloween time yet, still September. I've talked about this last couple weeks, but I'm still doing Halloween horror movie type stuff. And I stumbled upon a bizarre little gem called Frankenhooker. Let me play the trailer, and then I'll talk a little bit about this movie, because there's some just weird stuff around this film. In this early 90s exploitation film, a wannabe mad scientist reanimates his dead fiancée with spare parts from dead prostitutes.
The makers of Basket Case and Brain Damage bring you...
Want a date?
Frankenhooker. Jeffrey Franken has a plan.
I just want to bring you back a little bit.
He has the ingenuity.
Female body parts.
He has everything he needs except the raw materials. Jeffrey's creation is alive.
Looking for some action?
Now a motion picture like no other. A tender story of love and romance.
Want a date?
when I was in high school and college during my formative years, I would go to these 24-hour horror movie marathons at this local theater. I mean, the marathon, they still do marathons like that, but they were extra special back then because you couldn't mimic a theater in your home environment, and you also didn't have YouTube where you can download a bunch of trailers and that kind of thing. It was kind of hard to get your hands on that stuff. And you go to these all-night movie marathons, and they'd show some classics, but they also show some weird stuff. And I remember they showed Frankenhooker one year. And not only that, they had the star, Patty Mullen, who was a Penthouse Pet of the Year. She did a personal appearance in the Frankenhooker outfit, which apparently I've talked to the organizers of it, and they said she wasn't keen on doing that, but she decided to do it. And she was there, and she signed autographs. I actually have a signed somewhere in my storage. I have a signed Frankenhooker poster from Patty Mullen. So I met her in person. I mean, of course, there were a bunch of smelly, nerdy guys waiting in line, so I just kind of blended right in. She looked fantastic in person, especially she was in this, you know, that purple bikini that the show had her in. It's the guy who did Basket Case. If you've ever seen Basket Case from the 80s, it's a goofy, weird movie. It's an exploitation movie, but it's not the 70s exploitation movie. It's different. And by the time you started really getting into the 80s, there were these movies that they would release in some smaller theaters, but they never got wide releases, and then they'd end up on home video. And there was just so much interesting stuff around Frankenhooker. The story is kind of stupid. I mean, but it's kind of wacky and goofy. You can even hear it in the trailer. They're like, oh, boom, 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 it's a hooker. But there's something weirdly appealing about it. I mean, to me, I was like 18, 19 when I saw it. And it has some nudity in there and some sex jokes and some inappropriate stuff. But it's really kind of mild. I watch it now, and I'm like, this is pretty mild. I mean, it was still got an R rating just because of some of the nudity. But even then, the nudity is not terribly graphic. You see a lot more on your average episode of Game of Thrones. But this movie was going to be struck with an X rating. And they actually ended up having to release it unrated. And you watch this movie now and you're like, why would this get an X rating? I mean, yeah, it's got a lot of these jokes and the jokes are pervasive. But I mean, this is not at all. To me, I would never in a million years peg this as an X rated movie. But apparently it was. But that just shows how the world has changed. I mean, this wasn't like Reanimator was one of these underground horror movies, but Reanimator was straightforward with its horror. It was actually really trying to do a authentic zombie movie. This is goofy and jokey from the beginning. And it's kind of fun that way. It's not to be taken seriously. And you can tell even when they're making the movie, every single shot of this film, from the regular everyday jokes to the more outrageous sex-filled stuff, it's done with its tongue firmly in its cheek. The other weird thing about this one is on the poster, it's on the VHS cover box and everything. There's a quote from Bill Murray, and I think he says something like, if you see any movie this year, it should be Frankenhooker. And I never understood, why was Bill Murray being quoted on this? There was never this explanation given. And apparently what had happened is when they're editing this movie, they're editing the movie Quick Change, which was a Bill Murray movie that same year. They did it at the same studio, and he got to know the people who worked on the movie, and the producer asked him for a quote. Which, to the great embarrassment of the director, but that's kind of funny, I think. And so he gave him this quote, and that ended up on the posters. And I'm just, you never understood why Bill Murray was on there, but he was. It's like available on a bunch of different free platforms, on Tubi and Pluto and Sling and Amazon. It's adult humor, we'll say. So, you know, put your parental controls on. You know, it has all the bawdy elements of the late 20th century exploitation, but it plays so much tamer and at times downright silly to the modern eye. But still, it's a fun lark. I'm going to say Frankenhooker kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is on a movie that there was a reason I chose this. If you remember last week, I talked about Dawn of the Dead. And of course, the original Dawn of the Dead was a George A. Romero film, was made in 1978. But when they did the remake, Sarah Pauly at the time was making her way as an actor. She was doing a lot of acting and stuff. I think she was in her early mid-20s. And I remember seeing Dawn of the Dead and enjoying her in that. I thought she did a good job. And when I went back and watched it, I go, oh, the other big Sarah Polley movie that I remember where she was an actor was Splice. You know, she's now an award winning. I mean, she won an Oscar for Women Talking for writing that last year. You know, kudos to her for then going and doing like serious film and everything like that. But I like her choice of just weird stuff. She was also in the movie Existence. I should watch that this month, too. But I like her as this sort of this genre actor from the 2000s. Let's talk about Splice. Two genetic scientists develop a hybrid life form using human DNA and must deal with the consequences of their actions.
Regulators and politicians, they tear us to pieces.
Millions of people are suffering and dying. What are the moral considerations of that?
This is illegal. We can go to jail for this.
Human cloning is illegal. This won't be human. Not entirely.
It's growing fast.
Days within a matter of minutes.
She's perfect. You've crossed the line.
What did you expect when you made it? Didn't you have a plan?
When this movie came out, it flopped super hard. Because it was not something that your average viewer is going to like. It is definitely an... I mean, as much as Frankenhooker was an exploitation movie, Splice plays completely as an exploitation movie. It plays as a David Cronenberg modern body horror type movie. That's really, if I were to say if there was any sort of connective tissue, and it's directed by Vincenzo Natali, but it certainly has this feel of David Cronenberg. It takes place in Canada and is about people working in a lab, and there's this sort of a psychosexual element to it. But ultimately, it falls into a type of subgenre that I love. And this subgenre is people going in a lab, trying to help humanity, and having that just go disastrously wrong. And there are movies like the Rise of the Planet of the Apes, the reboot of the Planet of the Apes series. I love that because it's like somebody's really trying to do something good for the world, and it just ruins everything. And that's what I love those movies. I just, there's something about them. And in the lab setting and, you know, it's also based on Frankenstein in a lot of ways. I mean, not exactly. I mean, weirdly, Frankenhooker has a little bit more connective tissue with Frankenstein. But like, I mean, the characters, the character of Adrian Brody's the guy, his name's Clive, which is Colin Clive played Victor Frankenstein in the original movie. Sarah Polley's character is named Elsa. Elsa Lanchester played the bride of Frankenstein. So there clearly is this awareness of the Frankenstein implications on this. And there's so much weird stuff that goes on with this movie. It's very Cronenberg-esque. And what's funny, when I saw the movie, I saw it at a press screening, and there was a thunderstorm coming through town at the time. And it knocked the power out at the movie theater. And suddenly, like, we had, like, 15 minutes left in the movie. And some crazy stuff happened in the movie already. And then the power just went out. They couldn't get it back on. I think the power came back on, but they couldn't get the projector working again. So they said, sorry, you got to go home. And so all the press saw 90% of the film. And we went home. And then, like, that Thursday night, I took my kids to see Marmaduke. And I said, here, go play on the games. I'm just going to run and catch the last 15 minutes of Splice. And the last 15 minutes are crazier than what happened up to that point. It's an over-the-top movie that is not for the weak of stomach or weak of heart, but I absolutely loved it. It's worth checking out. But yeah, Splice is a grisly and raw cautionary tales about the danger of science without regards to consequence. I'm going to say that Splice totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
And that's it for the show. I need to go. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Saw X, The Creator, and Paw Patrol, the mighty movie. Until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.